Welcome to the Living Dream Podcast. This is Giannis Martin on Halloween Saturday. I'm here with Ross Perlin, the author of Intern Nation, How to Earn Nothing and Learn Little in the Brave New Economy. This is a great book that came out earlier this year, and it's finally started the conversation on a topic that a lot of us have discussed informally for years, which is why people get stuck in internships where we feel overqualified, underpaid, if paid at all, and what we can do about it. So, Ross, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me on, Janusz.
So, Ross, like most people our generation, you had gone through a couple unfulfilling intern experiences, I guess, during and perhaps after college. What inspired you to take the jump and write a whole book about it?
When I was working as an unpaid intern during my master's degree in London, I started to meet tons of other interns. I was in this kind of intern district in London, full of nonprofits, full of little startups, exactly the kinds of offices that, you know, are often have more interns than regular employees. And it just got me kind of wondering about the larger phenomenon that we were a part of, realizing that this was like a generational rite of passage, that this was, you know, a major factor in a lot of workplaces and a lot of industries. And I looked around for good sources on the topic, just, you know, to answer basic questions like how many interns are there in, you know, in the U.S. each year, or what percentage of college students do an internship. And I couldn't really find anything. There are newspaper articles that come out each year just saying, oh, more people than ever are interning this year. But nobody had actually, you know, taken the phenomenon seriously enough to do some real research and kind of paint the picture, and also kind of start a conversation about the ethics of having a massive unpaid labor force at the heart of the economy and what this was doing to a generation and the effects on social inequality overall. So I started by just talking to lots of fellow interns, collecting stories, getting a sense of the range of experiences that were out there. And at first I thought, well, this would be a good, you know, magazine article. Nobody's even really done much of that. There was one nice piece in The Baffler, that fantastic magazine back in the 1990s by Jim Friedrich, but that only kind of was the tip of the iceberg. But as I got deeper into it, I saw the connections to a whole range of subjects, from kind of labor economics and the youth labor market, to changes in the nature of higher education, to digital culture and, you know, certain generational stories. So I decided there's clearly a book in this, and I'll try to kind of cover as wide a range of things as possible and hopefully start a larger discussion.
Great. And so when I was looking around for critiques of your book to see what kind of the more compelling counterarguments were, and there were two main types of reviews I saw on the negative side. There were certainly a lot of positive reviews. One is kind of the crotchety old man approach, which is that, you know, if you're smart and you work hard, you'll find a fulfilling job eventually, and this is kind of like a rite of passage. And then the second one is sometimes you'd see younger folks jump out and say, oh, well, you know, I worked for this publisher, and it was great, and I met all these cool people, and now look at me, I'm a full-fledged journalist. And it struck me as amusing because that's the very exception to the rule that you talked about. You know, do you want to talk about some of the more the more of the horror stories that you came across, and you know, you can talk about Disney, for example?
Yeah, I thought those reactions were interesting because people really, you know, people who really have a connection to this issue, most people have, you know, either done an internship, had an intern in their office, maybe had an intern working under them, or at least known somebody, you know, pretty close who's done an internship somewhere. It's such a pervasive phenomenon now that it's something that people immediately, you know, they hear about the book or they start reading it and they think, oh, well, you know, my internship was XYZ. Mm-hmm. But the point was to try to, you know, get people to see the larger phenomenon and to understand even if their particular internship worked out, or even if, you know, even if some companies or some offices do it well, you know, the larger story is still pretty sinister. So where you've had millions of people working unpaid or underpaid, doing significant work driving the bottom line of their organizations. So I began the book with this story about Disney World, which you just mentioned, because I thought it would kind of wake people up to the scale of the phenomenon. And it also kind of illustrates the trajectory of the history of what I call the internship boom, basically how in the last 30 years, essentially, the phenomenon has kind of come from nowhere to being a major feature of society and, you know, and a shared experience among, you know, millions of people, and now something that's even globalizing. So in 1980, Disney World was just looking to sort of have a small group of college students. They'd had young people working at the theme park before. They were looking to have a small group come and basically fill in while unionized, the regular unionized employees at the park, you know, were more likely to be taking vacations. So periods when the park was pretty busy, but, you know, workers wanted some time off. And they brought in, you know, like 150 or so, you know, young people, students from a few schools, people who were studying, you know, hospitality management, things directly relating to what they would be doing at Disney World. And the program has grown now to include something like 6,000 to 7,000 interns each year at Disney World. And that's out of a total of about 63,000 employees working that huge campus, which includes hotels, restaurants, obviously the rides, all kinds of things. And interns are doing, you know, most of the roles. Interns are parking cars as valets, they're flipping burgers, they're picking up trash, they're working as bellhops in the hotels, they're doing all of that, you know, all of that stuff just like regular employees would, but they're doing it right down at minimum wage, obviously not unionized, without any kind of workplace benefits, not receiving the training that is, you know, this kind of supposed to be part of an internship in the common usage. And so what we've seen with Disney World, and it's something that the unions down there, because, you know, still a large percentage of the workforce is unionized, of the regular workforce, but they've been powerless to stop it. Disney has essentially been able to use internships as a kind of loophole, barely just staying within the letter of the law in that case, because they do pay minimum wage, although what they do with international interns is a little more dubious, bringing them in on cultural exchange visas to flip burgers and park cars. Essentially, they've found a way to kind of use interns as a cheap labor mill, and that's in some ways representative of a whole range of horror stories. Companies going from an idea of like, oh, we'll provide training, we will bring the next generation of employees into our company and kind of ease them in through something called an internship, towards a sort of newer, more sinister idea connected to cost cutting. You know, of interns, young people, as a pliable, flexible, cheap labor force that we can sort of use however we need to.
Yeah, was it Hershey that had a recent controversy about their use of international exchange interns?
That was very interesting, yeah. I think, you know, as far as I know, that was the first time that, you know, international students, young people from other countries who wanted to come experience the U.S., had actually really protested, and they did it also in connection with some local unions, which I thought was really interesting that connection had been made. But yeah, it points to the fact that it's not just at Disney, but at Hershey. I know at Publix, which is a major supermarket down in Florida, also this has been an issue. I think there are lots of places that are now using, I think it's especially the J-1 visa, mm-hmm. which is supposed to be about cultural exchange. It's sort of an easy way to bring in people from other countries who think that they're going to get to experience America and that there's going to be sort of, you know, training and education involved somehow, but who are in fact being kind of brought in to work, you know, minimum wage jobs and to be kind of pliable for the employers because, you know, the employers figure, well, they don't know American law, they don't have a safety network here, they don't.
Right, they're going to leave if it gets too bad, then they'll go home and never complain again. So
right, and not only that, but I mean, it also kind of the fact that they are there, kind of on a company on a visa that the company helped out with, means that they can call ICE, you know, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement. And this is what Disney does. If they have a problem with one of the employees, they call up ICE, and within, you know, literally within 24 or 36 hours, that person is being escorted to the airport. And deported from the country.
Wow. So tell me about how two types of people have reacted to your book. First, has anybody contacted you since then about legal action that they've taken? It strikes me that, you know, taking legal action is really hard because you know, people are interns for such a short period of time, and it would be hard to bring a class action because, I guess in the case of Disney or something you could, but for most people who, you know, intern with a couple other people, you know, it's just not a viable path. So have you heard since the book about any interesting litigation in this area?
It can be difficult, I think, to build, you know, to build a class, you know, given that interns are often kind of scattered in small groups, you know, over different workplaces. But I've heard from a lot of people who realized after reading the book, or you know, haven't even read the book, but read some interview I did, and you know, realized that what they were doing or what they had done was illegal, and were upset and wanted justice. Now within that group, there are still, you know, some who are afraid to actually kind of go on the record in that way or to sue. But there are sort of two paths open to current or former unpaid interns or people who were paid less than minimum wage. One is to go through a kind of procedural administrative process with either the federal Department of Labor or their state Department of Labor, and that you know, it's not easy, but it's relatively easier than bringing a lawsuit. And people do that. Interns have been doing that more and more, and have been getting their back wages as a result. The one thing that doesn't do is really publicize the offenders and the situations. And so, I mean, I'm thrilled that a major lawsuit has recently started in the U.S., partly as an outcome of the book, against Fox Searchlight Pictures, which is a production company that was involved in the making of Black Swan. And two former interns from Black Swan who worked unpaid for a movie that made, I believe, $300 million in revenue. They are claiming their rights and attempting to get their back wages. But even more than that, even more than the money, it's they really have a commitment to bringing this issue to light and getting press for it. And they've recently got a fair amount of press about the lawsuit. And hopefully setting a strong precedent. They're working with a lawyer here in New York who, is focused on labor and employment issues. And so the case is still just beginning to unfold. They just sort of filed the complaint in New York, but I think it'll hopefully set a really strong precedent. And there's stuff going on in the UK also, where there've been a large number of complaints in front of employment tribunals that are now giving interns their back wages and I think demonstrating that companies need to, they need to think seriously about the legality of what they're doing before they offer unpaid internships.
Yeah, well, the Fox Searchlight litigation could send shockwaves through that industry, right? It strikes me that Hollywood probably has a ton of unpaid interns just because there's a million people trying to get ahead, and it's hard to get a gig when somebody competing with you who may be equally qualified is willing to step in and do it for free.
Film and entertainment, is definitely a notorious area, and I think that's part of why these two interns decided to bring the suit, and part of what they're saying in their complaint. This is a pervasive practice in an industry that needs to be, that needs to be brought to light. Exploitative internships, unpaid internships, they are sort of all over the place in the white collar world, but the worst cases often cluster in a certain group of industries, especially these so-called cool industries, mm-hmm. rock star, which are supposed to be rock star jobs, things like mm-hmm. film, entertainment, music, publishing, fashion, television, these areas that people are really desperate to get into. And so there's so much demand that I think employers have felt, well, that they can dictate the terms of entry and basically make young people work unpaid for lengthy periods. I mean, and become serial interns in many cases. Actually, have to work, four or five or more internships in order to break in, if they even manage to break in at that point. And so, the larger impact on those industries is something that I was really, interested in trying to demonstrate in the book, even though it's still unfolding. But I think what you're going to see is a narrowing of the voices in these, often very important fields, and includes things like politics as well. Yes. If you have industries where you have to pay to play, where you have to be able to have money come from at least a somewhat privileged background, to break in or else make very, very significant sacrifices, that's going to shut out a lot of people.
And that is exactly where I want to go next. The reception of your book by politicians, especially in Washington, where, as you point out, this practice is just out of control. You know, I was a campaign intern at one point in my college days, which is a little different because in that case you're kind of volunteering for a cause. But you know, on the Beltway, whether it's in congressional offices or think tanks, or there's a ton of unpaid internships. And so, do you find a sympathetic audience among people who would frankly be almost hypocritical if they said that you had a good point in your book?
I mean, I think people in Washington, D.C. are really switched on to this issue. They do understand that, you know, internships play a huge role in the Beltway and in politics. In general, unpaid work of various kinds, whether it's volunteers or interns, and the distinction is often kind of fuzzy. You know, unpaid labor plays a huge role in politics in general. That said, unfortunately, many politicians, you know, sort of refuse to really acknowledge the issue because they benefit so much from interns. And you know, obviously, Capitol Hill, DC think tanks, even a lot of federal agencies. Although some federal agencies pay, while others don't. You know, they are up to their ears in, you know, what should be considered illegal internships. But Congress has actually, and this is really sinister, exempted itself with a special clause. We haven't really gotten into the law of internships, but generally speaking, if an internship is not essentially a training situation, then it does need to be paid like any other form of work. But Congress has managed to specially exempt itself from the law. And there's even discussion now that the Congressional PAGE program, the sort of historic PAGE program, has been cut. I know there's even a proposal on the table to replace those people with yet more unpaid interns. The PAGEs used to be paid because it was an older program. And, you know, I think back then there was no thought of bringing young people to Washington and not paying them something for their work. So I think, you know, there needs to be a politician who actually really steps up and takes up this cause and says, you know, at least writes a letter to the Department of Labor and says, you know, we should be enforcing this this existing law. I know there are people at the Department of Labor who are concerned with the issue. I spoke on a panel with one of them in Washington, D.C. There are people there who understand it. And, you know, they're waiting in some sense for some political will to back them up, I think.
So what would happen if people followed your advice in the private and public sector? Would there be like a day after tomorrow effect of industries that couldn't handle the prospect of surviving by paying even a minimum wage to every person who currently interns for them?
I think a lot of people are concerned that, you know, if you actually enforce the law around internships, that opportunities for young people would disappear. But the fear is well overblown. Essentially, what we're talking about is at least enforcing basic minimum wage. And so you can kind of study former instances of, you know, where minimum wage was brought in that didn't exist before. And conservative economists are always saying, well, minimum wage kills jobs. You need to just sort of let the market determine it. But through detailed studies made by many economists across the world in numerous cases, it's shown that having a minimum wage and enforcing that minimum wage is something that lifts all boats. It puts more money in people's pockets, so it ultimately is growing the economy. I don't think there would be huge adverse effects from having, you know, from just having basic standards around internships, from having an internship bill of rights. And there are a lot of issues that I talk about in the book that, you know, are issues even just of basic decency and not don't have any kind of major economic, you know.
Right. So couldn't companies go the other way and instead of a nonprofit doesn't have any money for paying interns, but couldn't they go the other way and just make sure they're actually doing what they're supposed to be doing with respect to mentoring and training.
Right, that would totally be possible within the law as it exists now. And I think I mean, I personally think there should be scope for training, you know, training programs where, you know, there's such a strong investment from the company for a short period of time from the firm, that pay doesn't have to be involved because it's essentially a training program. I think that's fine. It's certainly within the limits of the law. So I think it would force firms to choose, basically, are we
right.
running a training program here, or are we asking for a worker? And I think in some cases they would say, well, it's a worker. So, you know, and then they might decide then, well, why don't we just hire an entry-level employee? And I think this would actually help bring back entry-level jobs, which have become something of an endangered species thanks
right.
to internships. So, you know, I think so you might lose some internships to entry-level jobs. You might, you know, you might see some firms say, well, actually, we've never been able to make that, you know, very good use out of interns anyway. We don't have a very good program here, so we're going to get rid of it. I think the internships that would disappear, I don't think it would be a large number, and I think they would be the really low-quality ones. And I don't, you know, I don't think that every opportunity is a good opportunity. I don't think that we should have people continually sort of on a mill going through exploitative bad internships. And the ultimate, larger, more important effect, I think, would be to just sort of reopen opportunities and industries to people, especially in kind of in the white-collar world, you know, for people who can't afford to work unpaid, for people who are working their way through college, even for people who are not going to college, kind of reopen those doors and those industries to people.
So switching gears to something we were chatting about right before this call started, Occupy Wall Street. I think, to me, Occupy Wall Street connects to your book in an interesting way, that Occupy Wall Street is really about getting people to wake up and reassert their rights, whether that's First Amendment right or the right to a fair economic system, a fair tax system, system of equal accountability. You know, part of the intern nation that we have today is the result of the psychological state of, you know, the last, I guess, two generations that have gone through this intern nation, where people are kind of resigned to, you know, well, you know, it's a tough market out there. I probably should take an unpaid internship. I don't know if I deserve a full-paid job right now, given how things are. And Occupy Wall Street is kind of combating this, you know, attitude that's been the result of being, you know, kicked on the ground for so many years by most of this country. So do you feel a connection between, you know, the energy at Occupy Wall Street and the need for people to assert their rights?
I do. I think, you know, I would love to see an Occupy Internships, Occupy Intern Nation. I think that what you say is exactly right. I think people have had the attitude, well, I'm not worth anything. You know, I don't have my MBA yet or whatever it is, and so, you know, I don't deserve pay. And they're being told, you know, by professors, by career advisors, by their parents, you know, basically do whatever it takes. Use whatever advantages you have. If that's your support network, or, you know, fine. You know, do whatever it takes to break in. You know, underbid the other guy. And, you know, what I would especially like to see come out of Occupy Wall Street, but I feel, you know, I do feel, you know, is there in the movement and what some people are saying, is a sense of solidarity. You know, on a generational level, definitely on a, you know, on a wider level too, you know, for the 99%, a kind of solidarity that says, I'm not going to underbid the other guy. You know, I'm
mm-hmm.
not going to, you know, I understand the fact that doing an unpaid internship may actually be displacing or replacing like a regular job, a regular worker. And if we all do that, if we're all just looking out for ourselves, this is the kind of system we're going to end up with, a race to the bottom. So I think building that sense of solidarity among people and thinking really consciously about labor issues and the, you know, the nature of work and the structure of our economy, not just thinking, this is my situation, this is what I've got to do, but looking at it on a broader plane is vital going forward.
So what are you up to these days, Ross?
I'm hoping to work on another book that you know, builds on Intern Nation. Probably won't be like Intern Nation 2, the sequel. I think there are other people who will be, you know, who are writing about this issue and researching it, and hopefully, you know, I'll stay involved, stay in the conversation, and hopefully, kind of, ultimately, try to reverse the tide. But I want to write something kind of larger about inequality in America, and especially in kind of places that people don't usually go. So I'm hoping to spend some time in more remote parts of America that have really been left behind.
Great. And last question, which I'm obliged to ask, how did you use interns in the publishing process for your book?
Well, if the book didn't have any other effect, I can say that it did get my publisher, Verso Books in New York and London, it did get them to change their internship policy.
Awesome.
So in the process of publishing the book, through their reading it, through my discussions with them, they decided that they would start paying their interns. And it's even a little more than minimum wage. And it's not that many interns. It's a small publishing house. But it's interesting just because they're a very socially conscious, left-wing political press that's done amazing things. But they had never, thought that much about their internship program. They simply did what everybody else does and took on some unpaid interns when they needed some extra work. So they changed that policy. They have paid interns now. There were a couple of interns through Verso who did some great things for the book. So, that was one very cool effect.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for coming on to chat. Again, the book is Intern Nation, How to Earn Nothing and Learn Little in the Brave New Economy. So Ross Perlin, thanks again and have a great day.
Thanks
for
your
good work.
Bye.
Yeah.